I'm Tim. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
My sobriety day is April 30th, 2007. I just celebrated 18 years since my last drink. At 71 years old, you can say that I'm still a spiritual teenager. And I probably have the maturity of a teenager, but you'll find out as I tell the story. To get started, I'd like to thank Frank B. for inviting me to come share my experience, strength, and hope with you today. I'm going to now try my version of one of AA's most popular speaker icebreakers. So if you heard this before, I hope I do it up to your standards. There was once a young lady and a newcomer who was both shy and dyslexic, who listened in on a few season AAs horsing around the coffee pot. They were giggling about the ironic fact that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous presents our healthy perspective on the human sexual condition on page 69. This piqued her interest because she thought her sex life might be over as a result of getting sober. So being dyslexic, she rushed home to open her Big Book to page 96, not 69. And imagine what was going through her mind when she read, "Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer." Wow.
Good advice.
I've got another quickie from one of your recent speakers, Tinsley Ellis, who we're real happy that he's part of our home group at the Monday Night Blue Chip speaker meeting at NABA. It's a quickie. Somebody reminded me, they quoted him yesterday morning at my Fresh Air group meeting at the Hawk Club. It's a 7:30 Saturday meeting. If you're ever in town, it's a good meeting. Tinsley says, "If I could be a normal drinker, I'd be drunk every day." And that makes sense to me as an alcoholic. I spent my first couple of years in AA mostly at the NABA Clubhouse, officially known as the Northside Alcoholics Benevolence Association, where I remain an active AA home group member of the weekly Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. The Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting has an ever-expanding AA recovery website, which you may or may not be aware of. It's called aabluechipspeakers.org. So I'll say that again. It's aabluechipspeakers.org. And we created this 15 years ago. Some may say that we go overboard and that we usually record our speakers with their permission, and with their further permission, we put them online to reach out to the alcoholic who still suffers. We first started featuring online speaker recordings on the NABA Club website 17 years ago. They have their website, and we now have ours, but we didn't in the beginning. Pretty soon we were dominating the NABA homepage. And we had all these speakers up there, and other groups were like, "What the hell? What's going on here?" So after a little bit of wrangling and wrestling over NABA Club resources, a fine and skilled lady named Donna P. created the aabluechipspeakers.org website. And I had very little to do with it, but I gave her my opinions, you know, and I told her what I'd like to see. And for the first time in my life, somebody actually did what I was talking about. It's really a pretty website. It's easy to navigate, and I can add speakers to it. And right now, we've got about 900 speakers. Hopefully, we'll have somebody trained to keep it going forward. You know, they say that spirit of rotation, it's about time pretty soon that somebody steps up. But right now, it's growing. It's easy to navigate even for the non-techie. Our online Monday 8 p.m. recordings go back to 2008. My sponsor, Tim Moore, who happens to be sitting right back there on the back row keeping his mouth shut, trying to be under the radar, has been in the meeting longer than I have, by almost 4 years. And this was where I came to my very first AA meeting, and I met Tim M. I picked up a white chip that night at the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. I'll talk about that a little later. As I said, my sponsor since my beginning is Tim M. My grand sponsor is Ken Horvath, a longtime member of the 615 Dawnbusters group at 8111. He's now just settled with his wife in Hilton Head Island, which was once an old haunt of mine when I first got out of college. Back then, in my early 20s, I made a bit of local history partying my ass off. My great-grand sponsor was a gentleman who was well-known to many as Papa Bill. When I came into the program, I was 53 years old, and I thought I was already over the hill. Papa Bill went to his first AA meeting and picked up a white chip when he was 60. He lived to be in his 90s. Those 30 years, he sponsored dozens of sober guys. He sponsored hundreds of guys. He was a true inspiration. When I first heard about Papa Bill, I began to hope that maybe I could survive a little longer. One day, Tim said that we should go see Papa Bill at 8111. When we walked in, it seemed like we were approaching the wise Yoda of Star Wars. He seemed to be glowing with spiritual light while hovering mystically inches above his chair. It was probably my imagination, because I just started living one day at a time. I see things. When introduced to him, he simply smiled with, "Welcome to AA, Tim. Are you happy, joyous, and free?" Awestruck, I reverently replied, "Not yet, but I really want to be." He said, "Well, just hang out with us, stick like glue to your sponsor, Tim Moore, and truly work all these 12 steps with the best of your ability. And I promise you, you too will soon be happy, joyous, and free." And Papa Bill knew what he was talking about. I hope it's okay to pause for a moment and just say a little prayer to try to collect myself and try to get into the right spirit of things. God, please direct our thinking tonight so that those thoughts are divorced of self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear. God, inspire our thinking, decisions, and intuitions. Help us to relax and take it easy. Free us from doubt and indecision. Guide us tonight and show us our next step. God, please help me find the words to better express your will so that we may be of maximum service to you and our fellows through the power of the steps, your powerfully loving way of life. We pray. Amen. And I now say amen a lot. If I do any more prayers, you'll probably hear it again. Now, let's go back to the beginning. I was born an Air Force brat in the small town of Bourne next to Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Even when I was a little kid, I knew that was kind of different. You know, I was born in Bourne. Most of my life, I was raised in the Deep South, but being in an Air Force family, we traveled all over America from my beginning. By the first grade, we were one of the first families to be stationed in then primitive Daegu, Korea, where yoked oxen shared the road with our woolly jeeps, and mourners wailed from nearby burial mountains during all hours of the night. Our last station in Asia was in Tokyo, where unfortunately my father, Captain Dave, who was a highly skilled jet pilot, had a fatal air crash because of a faulty oxygen system in his tandem Shooting Star T-33. I was 6 1/2, and even worse for my younger sister, it was the day before her 3rd birthday. That was tough. It was real tough. He was a larger-than-life character, and he certainly left big shoes to fill. He had once been an all-SEC varsity football tight end at Auburn University. His senior year, he played under Ralph Shug Jordan, who was a legendary coach that had a good run of success in the 50s and early 60s. Vince Dooley was then a freshman quarterback. Vince was always a friend of the family going forward through his illustrious career as Georgia Bulldog head football coach and athletic director. My father's remains were given military honors by his graveside with a 21-gun salute at Vicksburg, our Southern National Cemetery overlooking the Mississippi River. There was also a missing man squadron flyover. It was a powerful and overwhelming spectacle I'll never forget. It was overwhelming. My young uncle, who was 14 at the time when the service was over, came over to me, putting his arm around me, and he solemnly said, "Tim, You're now the man of the house. It's your job now to take care of your mother and baby sister. That hit me like a ton of bricks. I was 6 years old. I didn't know what to make of that. And from Vicksburg Cemetery, my little sister and I were sent to my grandparents' home in Jackson, Mississippi, so our mother could grieve alone and get our new home ready to move in. My grandfather, David, held the office of General Secretary of the Mississippi Methodist Church for 30 years. He got his Ph.D. in theology at Vanderbilt, and he really was a Southern Christian gentleman. And like Jesus, he was also a very handy carpenter. He surprised me by building a fabulous treehouse over his backyard patio in no time. This treehouse was right out of Leave It to Beaver or some other classic family sitcom. It was great. I was the oldest grandchild, so it was my job to break it in for all my future cousins. They let us watch Gunsmoke one night on TV. That was a rare occasion. Being like six, I was always sent to bed. We hadn't a chance to watch much TV. We'd usually get sent to bed early. And that show, there was this bad guy who Marshall Dillon had captured, who was convicted of cold-blooded murder. When they put that hangman's noose around his neck and hung him high, it looked vividly real to the six-year-old kid who loved to play cowboy. Of course, some stuntman did it, and they had all the props to make it look real. But I was a little kid obsessing. How did they do that? That next morning, I went into my grandfather's tool room, and there was a rope that was just perfect for tying a noose. So I made a nifty noose, and then I looped rope up under my arms as a safety harness.
Right.
I was young, but I wasn't dumb. And I had the noose coming up out of my T-shirt, and I tied it to a limb at the treehouse, and I soon was just hanging there, entertaining myself in make-believe. Just then, my grandmother, she was a dignified matron and a first cousin of the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn. I mean, she was not to be trifled with. She came out to tell me it was time to wash up for lunch. And she went down. She hit the floor, fainted, nearly dead away. This was not make-believe. My father just had been violently killed in a fiery air disaster, and her first impression was their only mixed-up grandson, had just hung himself to end it all. Grandmother, grandmother, I called out while unwrapping myself from my make-believe noose. But she was out cold. So I go to the sink, wet a little dish towel, and as I'm patting her face with it, she opens her eyes, first in disbelief, then outraged alarm. She grabbed me and nearly hugged the life out of me. Then she wore my little ass out. You'd say that I had it coming to me. From that moment on, I was the loose cannon of the Ridgeway family. Every time we'd come back for the summer each year, she'd go on edge. She was thinking, what in the world is this little troublemaker going to do next? Poor lady, I traumatized her to her last nerve, which lasted between us for most of the rest of her life. I was soon going to find myself addicted to cigarettes at an early age in the third grade in Columbus, Georgia, my mother's hometown. I started smoking rabbit tobacco with my friends around a campfire in the woods. We were always running wild in the woods, swimming in the creeks, chopping down trees, shooting air rifles. So I started sneaking cigarettes out there from my mother's Parliament blue and white cigarette pack. They had recessed filters. I felt so sophisticated and mature for only being 8 years old. My friends would pass one around, and they would hardly puff anything, while I was taking deep inhales from the get-go. They warned me, you better watch out, you're going to get addicted. I was like, nah, I don't think so. Well, they were right. By the time I was in fourth grade, I was a pack-a-day smoker. I had to sneak around like being a fourth-grade secret agent, lying and cheating and stealing. I had to get cigarettes somehow. I needed a fix. I was pretty good at getting them, learning to shoplift at the grocers and seeking out out-of-the-way vending machines. So I fed that nasty early habit all through elementary school and junior high. I even played sports with that habit. I was the biggest kid in my class, and I would hide my crush-proof Marlboros in my shoulder pads for football practice and sneak out to the woods to sneak a cigarette before and after practice. Most of the adults smoked back then, or so it seemed, and nobody ever confronted me. Really, I mean, until I was 16. I was just sneaking around. Those were my worst character defects, and they were developed at an early age. And when I came to my first AA meeting 45 years later to pick up a white chip at the end of that meeting, and they read how it works, I slightly pondered rigorous honesty. What's that? I figured that I was going to be one of those constitutionally incapable types. But you know, I found that if you come all the way into the room and just keep coming back, one day at a time, a change in me will take root. There's hope for all of us. We have a program of second chances. My mother was a grieving widow, which led me into wanting to deaden my feelings with cigarettes early in my life, deep inhaling and doing all that before I ever could get my hands on alcohol. But we were soon to have plenty of alcohol in the house. My second stepfather, a classy gent, kept a well-stocked bar. I also had an uncle Buddy who was a severe alcoholic, and he would go on terrible binges. He'd go 3 months without a drink, and he'd be the nicest, sweetest man in the world. Then he'd have one drink and then go on a binge, always to get tossed in the drunk tank down in Columbus. They got a song about that down there, way down in the Columbus stockade. Wish I was back in Tennessee. My friends have all turned their back on me. He knew that song pretty well. Lordy, he smelled worse than a goat every time we bailed him out. He always had to fumigate the car. So my mother said, I'm going to teach my kids to drink like a lady and a gentleman. She would get out the fine crystal, chinaware, and silver. We'd have a big formal family dinner on special occasions. We were taught what fork to use, when to use it. She would serve white wine with chicken and fish courses and red wine with beef and venison, all followed by an array of after-dinner liqueurs with dessert. So my sister and I were just well-treated children trained to eat and drink with good manners. But none of it tasted too good to me, so I just sip on it, just like the adults at the table instructed. I soon had the bright idea to volunteer and clear the table, taking all those half-full glasses and pouring them into a big plastic Slurpee cup. Add just the right amount of Kool-Aid, ice it down real good, and sneak back to my room to soon whirl out while my bed would spin wildly by the end of the night. That's the way I did it then, and that's the way I did it for a few years. We didn't do it every night, so it wasn't obvious to me that I was an alcoholic right away. But looking back, I already had alcoholic behavior from the very beginning. When I got to Sandy Springs High School in North Atlanta, I figured out that I could buy a bag of pot, maybe a $20 bag of pot, and I can make a couple of $5 nickel bags, then maybe a $10 dime bag, and somehow end up with free pot. It started out simple as that, and when I was 53 years old, at the end of my rope, I was still doing stuff like that. What I mean to say is that I never grew up until I was sponsored through the 12 steps. My maturity stopped when I was like 8 years old, when I started smoking. When I started drinking, I really regressed, or advanced, whichever way you look at it. I drove a demodified Camaro dragster for a couple of years in high school, which made me a bit of a daredevil, and there would soon become another treehouse in my story. My high school girlfriend's little brother was probably only 12 years old, and he asked me to be his bootlegger and dope dealer for his little group of crazy neighborhood friends. I meet them almost every Friday night at that treehouse in Sandy Springs with a bag of pot and cases of cold beer, rum, juice, ice, and party cups. You can say he and his pals financed our romance. I had a lot more pocket money for dating than I would have had, and at the same time, I became addicted to easy money. Her little brother will come up later in my story once AA finally comes into the picture. After high school, I went to the University of Georgia. Despite a so-so high school grade point average, I somehow got in only because I did well on my SAT scores. I don't know why. I didn't put a lot of effort into my academics, and then once I got to UGA and found myself drowning in schoolwork, I discovered those magic speedy powerhouses called RJS Black Beauties and Red and Blacks. I regularly stayed up all night before an exam or an essay. I graduated with honors, and it wasn't because of a hard work ethic. I had heard that if you study while you're drinking, you better be drinking when you go take the test. So I did just that, earning honors degree in journalism. I kept a buzz on all the time after starting my freshman year because Georgia dropped the drinking age to 18 when I went to college at 17 with a fake ID. By New Year's Day, I was legally using my real driver's license to buy anything and go anywhere. After VGA, I met my wife on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. After a few years, she gave me a son. And then, for her own good reason, she became my ex-wife. My son is now 46, and we played disc golf this morning at Wessel Park in Gainesville to celebrate Father's Day. So there's a whole lot of water under that bridge right there. After settling back in Atlanta, where my son was born, I was desperate to get myself into a real career. I had this journalism degree, and I'd been working like a drunken slave for a long string of newspapers as a photographer and a reporter, regularly working over 60 hours a week, and I probably would have worked a lot less if I didn't drink so much. But I was only making peanuts, and I told myself I might as well go into the military and go to officers' candidate school. With that thought in mind, I talked my way into an exciting commission salesman job in the meantime at Andy's Sport Car Center in Smyrna. Then I really started thinking about joining the United States Air Force. Eureka, I decided to be a jet pilot like my dad. So I decided to see this recruiter. I'm 26 years old, and you've got to do all this before you're 27 in order to go in with a chance to be an officer. The Air Force recruiter asked if I've got a degree. I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "What's it in?" I said, "Journalism." According to him, the Air Force doesn't really need a lot of journalists. "Well, that's okay. I'm going to be a jet pilot." He asked, "Oh, you sure of that?" I said, "Yes, sir." He then asked, "Do you have any DUIs?" So I said, "Only two." Poor guy, he goes, "No way. There's absolutely no way." I said, "But what if I get some really important letters of recommendation?" He said, "They'd better be damn good letters of recommendation." So I said, "Well, let me see what I can do." Now, going back to when I was at UGA, I joined a fraternity on River Road, and my stepfather was friends with Senator Herman Talmadge, who was an older brother to me in the fraternity that had just pledged. So if Senator Talmadge surprised me when I was a freshman by sending a letter on United States Senate letterhead to my dorm on Baxter Street, welcoming me to UGA and fraternity life. He finished the letter with, "Let me know of any assistance I may be to you." So at last, I was in need of a favor for a letter of recommendation so I could enter OCS as a candidate to earn my wings as a jet pilot, failing to mention my two recorded DUIs. I mailed him a copy of the letter he had sent me 10 years before, along with my fresh letter asking him for a letter of reference. And boom, within a week, there it was. I got back this golden boss letter from one of the two Georgia senators. I hadn't even thought about what I was going to do once I got that letter. I realized that the other Georgia senator was the chairman of the Armed Forces Committee in the Senate. So I made a copy of the first senator's letter and sent the second senator an unsolicited request to also be a character reference. He don't know me from squat. And lo and behold, in just a few more days, I had glowing letters from two Georgia senators. And at the same time, past Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter had just been elected President of the United States of America. So I made the copies of those letters and overnighted them with my personal request, special delivery, to the White House. Oh, my God. Boom. Was that a monster letterhead with a mighty golden boss presidential seal? I didn't even think about how inappropriate all that was. All in the name of my father's memory, I now can clearly see his spirit pleading, "Oh, for goodness sake, son, please don't do this." But I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it now. So I took those letters to the recruiter, and he greeted me with, "You're the guy with the DUIs, right?" And I said, "Yes, sir. And I promise I'd get you these letters of recommendation." I laid them out side by side on his desk like I was revealing a winning three-card money hand. Two jacks with a king high. He looked at them in amazement, rubbing his temples and whispers to himself, "Oh, my God, I want you to know that I did feel terrible for that, what I put that guy through when I was working through my fourth step with Tim. Let me see what my superiors say." At once, taking the letters, tucking them neatly in a file, he called me after a couple of days and said, "Okay, you've got a green light, but only if you can pass all the required tests. You'll have to go through basic training, then OCS, before flight training. If you can cut it, we'll overlook those DUIs." All this time, I'm drinking like a fish, living in a fantasy. I was working at Andy's Sport Car Center, selling and driving Jaguars, MGs, Triumphs, Rovers, and Lotus Esprit, a bunch of other fancy European sport cars. You know, my head's spinning. I told my owner, fellow salesman, and any customers about my exciting dream of becoming a jet pilot in the United States Air Force. They usually wish me the best of luck. And on the last day before induction, the crew at Andy's threw me a going-away party. No. Guess who got really smashed that night? I had passed every kind of written test, and it was time to leave for Robins Air Force Base, where they first gave me a physical and a routine eye exam, which I passed with 20/20 vision. I had one more eye test, and that was for a possible astigmatism. On the first try, I flunked it. Pretending to misunderstand the instructions, I took it again, this time answering the exact opposite of what I was seeing. The doctor was so impressed that he gave me a third test. Switcheroo, he tricked me and discovered I was a liar. He said, "Listen, there's no way you're going to fly our latest fighter jet. We're not going to trust you with a high-performance, multi-million-dollar aircraft with weaponry that can wipe out half the state of Georgia. Well, if you're not going to let me do that, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to do any of it," I huffed. "Think about it. Don't throw away an excellent career of getting to do a great service for your country." He laid it all out for me. And that's when my fear of going through all this with so many days and weeks without alcohol kicked in. I asked myself at this critical moment, was I really able to go through all this stone cold sober? Am I really going to stop drinking and go to boot camp, then go to OCS? Then I must wait 3 months between drinks and always do the next right thing? If I put it that way, I'm certainly not. I hopped in my getaway car, escaping to the first package store for instant relief from this madness. I didn't call home, and by the time I got home, I was stewed to the max, fumbling to put the key in the door. I staggered into the living room, astonishing my disappointed wife with, "Honey, I'm home." Horrified, she gasped, "What about all your big plans?" And I said, "They were about to Shanghai me, so I just decided not to do it." Oh, that poor woman married with child to such an arrogant partner. In retrospect, it was my only way out, because if I had really gone in there and blew it with all those elite conjured up letters, that would have been a disaster for everyone involved. So I eventually found myself powerless at 51 years old when we had a member of the family that had dramatic alcohol intervention, suddenly getting locked up at the Ridgeview Institute for Alcoholic Treatment. This really freaked me out, because I always figured that I was much worse alcoholic than she ever was. I was convinced that they were coming for me next. That Thanksgiving day, I quietly decided to go cold turkey, dropping to my knees, begging God to get me out of this mess again. I somehow made it one day at a time without any knowledge of the doctor's opinion, of AA, of the big book, or anything real. So after about a month of begging God, the phenomenon of craving subsided, and I started telling myself that I had found willpower. So I stopped begging God, relying only on ego, and then after nearly a year, just before the next Thanksgiving, my sister Pam calls, asking me if I was still not drinking. "You bet," I replied with great pride. So at our family Thanksgiving, after the blessing, instead of a toast, I was presented with a one-year AA medallion without ever going to an AA meeting. My sister thought anyone who drank like I did must have had to be going to AA all along to stay off the sauce for a whole year. It was a real nice gesture from the family and very supportive, but I really didn't know how to deal with that because I knew secretly that I had never, ever been in an AA meeting. I didn't understand the significance of that bronze medallion or the customary chip system marking our time since our last drink. Things would go haywire with my mother on Christmas morning a little while later. She suffered a stroke, then fell and broke her hip with a nasty compound. She began a seven long process of dying. Under duress, I started to romance a glass of red wine with a fine dinner. I was just going to have a nice dinner with a simple glass of red wine, like the gentleman I was trained to be as a child. And to my delight, that worked out great. Just that one time, I didn't even finish the glass of wine. I had a cup of coffee before killing it and congratulated myself on being self-restrained at last. Sadly, after that night, all I thought about was when I'm going to have my next glass of wine. And I could just see that wine glass in my head being brought regally to my table. I put my next drink on the calendar and waited for 6 or 7 days until finally the moment came to get my hands that next glass of wine. This time I just slugged it like a shooter. And then the next day I stormed into the package store and stocked back up on high gravity beers, energies. I didn't even know they had energy beers. And handles of vodka, rum, Crown Royal, and cases of organic European red and white table wine. And then I stayed in a steady blur from January through April 30th, 2007. I was finding my bottom. I was holed up in the cellar of the lake house in Gainesville. My sister pops in unexpectedly and says, "Hey, bro, how you doing?" I said, "Not good." "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I can't stop drinking." "Well, what about your AA medallion? We thought you had quit drinking." "Well, I did for over a year, but lately I've been sneaking around again. Can't stop." She agreed that I was good at sneaking around. She asked, "What do you want to do about it?" I said, "I don't know." "What do you think I ought to do about it?" She answers with no hesitation, "I know exactly what we're going to do about it. Just pack a bag. We're going to an AA meeting." It was Monday, and we were off to my very first AA meeting. She drove me straight to the Nava Club down I-85 to the Claremont exit. It just so happened to be the regular night for the weekly Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip speaker meeting. The speaker, David C., had 12 years of sobriety, and he was a sponsee of Bill Sanders, who was the chairperson of the Lanaman's workshop, and a really good speaker. I didn't recognize David C. It finally dawned on me when he spoke about the treehouse in Sandy Springs and his big sister's boyfriend that got him started down the road to ruin when he was 12 years old, and there I was, the bad guy, sitting in on my very first AA meeting, being a dark part of his story. When he finished on a high note of hope and service, a volunteer offered up a white chip, and I jumped up and grabbed it as if my life depended on it. Dave recognized me immediately after the Lord's Prayer, telling me I looked rough, and asked, "How long have you been out?" Confused, I told him that I didn't really know what he meant. When he asked me seriously, "How long have you been out?" He said, "This couldn't be your first white chip now, is it?" I said, "This is my very first AA meeting, and I don't know what the hell's going on," I replied miserably. That night, I met my future sponsor, Tim M. He got me a big book out of the literature cabinet, and he gave me some valuable advice. He said, "Just listen. Don't complicate things. Keep it simple. When you get home, get on your knees. Ask your higher power for the strength not to drink. And then when you finish that simple prayer, climb into bed, open up this big book, start reading from the front cover, and keep reading until you fall asleep." I told him that my prayers had stopped working. He doubled down, patiently telling me again what to do. So I followed his exact suggestions and may have read one paragraph over and over. But I fell asleep without taking a drink. For 4 months, I had drunk myself into oblivion each and every night. I woke up that morning without a hangover, without cotton mouth, without wetting the bed. It was my very first miracle in recovery. I dropped down to my knees in gratitude and prayed to this new higher power. "Thank you, thank you, thank you. Amen." I went back to Napa the next day, at least. I believe that's what happened. To be honest, I don't know what the hell happened the whole next day. I know I had DTs rolling around on my sister's living room carpet in a panic attack. And if it hadn't been for Pam rushing in and grabbing me and just compassionately holding me down, I would have gone through a wall or something. I'd never been drinking or binging on alcohol in those insane amounts like that ever before. My liver was like a set of old bald tires. It was flat, worn out. I needed a fresh liver. I never got a fresh liver. They put me on the list at Piedmont Hospital for a while until I healed up. 3 years sober, I found I had stage 4 colon cancer. The doctor said, get your affairs in order. And I said, well, I'm living in all the 12 steps. Do I have to do any more than that? To which they said, that sounds like a good start, not knowing what to do with me. It just turned out that for me, I just needed to keep doing this thing one day at a time. In my opinion, I came to find the world's greatest surgeon, and he gave us a very reasonable payment plan with me not having any insurance. I paid him just a little bit of money every month for several years. I finally paid for his surgery and follow-up care. He removed 40% of my colon and 16 of the associated lymph nodes to that diseased section. He installed a chemo port directly into my heart and removed it 8 months later without anesthesia, which was totally amazing and scary. Miraculously, I haven't had any repercussions since then. I also took 12 chemo treatments. About 5 years ago, an oncologist said, I'm not going to say you're not going to die of cancer one day, Tim, but you're not going to die of that particular cancer. That cancer is gone. And he said, I always know, being in the cancer business, that I'll always lose my patient. They'll either die or they will get well. This was our last appointment, and I gave them a strong hug goodbye. God willing, I'm still doing this thing one at a time, and I haven't had a drink since April 30th, 2007. So please try our group out on our growing YouTube channel, AA Blue Chip Speakers. Nearly 900 recordings of experience, strength, and hope to freely download. Please go to or Google aabluechipspeakers.org. If you're ever willing to tell your story at the NABA Club, please let me know, and we'll put you on the Blue Chip Speaker calendar. As Bill Wilson said, when pain comes, we're expected to learn from it willingly. Help others to learn. When happiness comes, we accept it as a gift and thank God for it. Regarding emotional sobriety, I believe that emotional sobriety is less about the quality of feeling good or bad and more about the general ability to feel one's feelings. Being restored to sanity isn't about getting the brass ring or cash or prizes or being happy, joyous, and free all the time, but it's about being in the present moment, whatever it happens to look like. What are you experiencing right now? Can you be present with all your feelings without any one of them defining you? Sometimes emotional sobriety is about tolerating what you're feeling. It's about staying sober no matter what you're feeling. It means that you don't have to blame yourself or your program because life can be challenging. It means that you don't necessarily need to do something to make the feeling go away. Dr. Bob advised, it's the most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which we are afflicted. For many of us, our health is good, and we have regained our self-respect and respect for our colleagues. Our home lives are 12 steps closer to ideal, and our businesses are good, as can be expected in these uncertain times. Many of us spend a great deal of time passing on what we have learned to others who want and need it badly. We do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it's a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, we're paying our debt to the man or woman who took time to pass it on to us. Four, because every time we do it, we take out a little more insurance for ourselves against a possible threat. I do have a little recording from Sandy Beach in 2013 for his finish of his story at the Atlanta Roundup. It's about 2 minutes long. It's okay if I play it.
So in the last minutes, then, I just want to say something to those of you that are new to AA. Our program is designed to give you a spiritual awakening so that you can be in touch with the creator of the universe on a personal basis, so that you experience yourself, an awareness of your own creator. It's already there, you're just not aware of it. I remember sometimes in hotels they would have reading rooms where you could go in and you're waiting for somebody and you could take a book off a shelf and sit there and read it. They had great big overstuffed chairs and all that. And I remember going in there, I looked around and it's empty. So I get a book and I'm reading and I'm there about a half an hour suddenly I realized there's someone else in the room. You know what I mean? You weren't aware of them. Now you are aware. They were there all the time. But suddenly you're aware. And it's the same thing with this higher power. It's there all the time. It's right as close as it can be. There's nowhere you can be that this presence isn't there. If you work these steps, there's going to come a day when you suddenly become aware of it. It's almost like it gets revealed to you. And you just go, oh. And that is the day that your life moves to another level. And my point is, don't miss it. Don't settle for just not drinking. Get to the next level. Don't cheat yourself out of what AA is really all about. If you do this, you'll be talking about it when you give talks. And you'll be telling people, oh my God, I almost missed the whole point of being alive. I almost missed the whole meaning of life. I missed the whole damn thing because I didn't try hard enough to have this awareness kick in. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it'll always materialize. So don't give up, and thank you for listening, and God bless everybody. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
First I slip, and then I quit. To a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, wake in there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises all live. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Something that's